This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Andrea Patino Contreras set out to document the stories of immigrants. Along the way, she learned a lot about the ways our economy is changing here and abroad, and she found out a bit about herself as a Colombian student in the States on a student visa. A recent Lewis Hine documentary fellow, Andrea found the cultural diversity of Lynn, Massachusetts profound and interesting. Almost 30% of Lynn's population is foreign-born. Andrea decided the stories of Lynn needed to be told, so she documented it with a multimedia exhibit that you can see at the Duke Center for Documentary Studies now through April 13th. And Andrea Patino joins us right now to talk on the state of things about From the World to Lynn, Stories of Immigration. Andrea, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Thank you so much for having me.
What attracted you to Lynn, Massachusetts?
So I ended up in Lynn, Massachusetts through the Hine Fellowship, which it's a fellowship at the Center for Documentary Studies. The way the fellowship works is that recent graduates are paired up with nonprofits. And I ended up going to Lynn to work with a nonprofit called Raw Artworks that does art therapy work with at-risk youth. So that's how I ended up in Lynn and kind of started discovering the city.
Well, tell us about that city, what it is today, and also maybe give us a little of its history.
So it's a pretty amazing and surprising place. I had never been to Massachusetts before, and when I moved there, everyone, and I told people I'm going to be working in Lynn, they were kind of surprised because if you go there, people will tell you there's nothing in Lynn, there's just violence, you know, the popular rhyme says Lynn, Lynn, city of sin, you never come out the way you come in. So it has a pretty bad reputation, I think, among even local people. And when I got there, I didn't know much about it, and I started doing research, just walking around, and I could hear all these different languages, Arabic, Spanish. There was a Russian bakery right there, a Greek Orthodox church, and that kind of intrigued me pretty quickly. And I started digging around for information, and I found out, as you mentioned, that almost 30% of Lynn's population is foreign-born currently, but that doesn't obviously take into account people who came, you know, 100 years ago. Right. From, you know, an earlier wave of immigration, and that is also has been part of the rich culture in Lynn. So I started digging around and found out that, you know, indeed Lynn is a pretty depressed city right now. Unemployment rates are higher than the state's average. High school dropouts, that sort of thing, is not in a really good shape, but it turns out that Lynn was a pretty prosperous city. Since it's when the first people kind of settled in Lynn in the 1630s, it became a center of shoe production pretty early on, artisanal shoe production. And it became pretty, pretty prosperous. And, you know, by the 19th century, when machines came in and industrialization happened, the industry really kind of grew dramatically. And Lynn had a crazy population growth between 1860 and 1910, the population grew by 450%, which is really crazy. So it went from being a 20,000 people city to a 90,000 people city, which in 1910. And today, Lynn's population is about the same that it was in 1910 for different reasons. But so that, I found that to be really, really interesting. The development of the shoe industry and how prosperous it was and what happened. So I was trying to figure out what had happened, why there are so many immigrants today there, and why it's in the shape that it is right now. So that's how I kind of became fascinated by it.
Yeah, because like much of New England, it's got this manufacturing base, right? And
right.
It goes back to the colonial period. Shoemaking became a way that it carved out a niche for itself. It becomes, in the industrial age, a center for shoemaking and manufacturing. Was it attracting immigrants then from Europe as part of this population growth, the European immigration that fueled our industrialization? It was part of that.
Absolutely.
It's part of the story of America. Then there's the industrial collapse in the United States.
Definitely.
When did that happen? What happened to the shoe industry in general, but in particular in Lynn?
So it was quite dependent on the shoe industry for the late 19th century, early 20th century. Then in the 1930s, General Electric came in, GE came in, and that became also a huge part of the economy. But the shoe, I think the shoe factories stayed there for a while and attracted a bunch of immigrants. A lot of Dominicans actually came in later in the century. But slowly, I think the industry moved abroad. The very last shoe industry in Lynn was burned down in 1981. And that kind of was the end of the shoe industry. And now, you know, the U.S. gets 99% of its shoes from abroad. So that kind of just moved away altogether. And those jobs were lost, of course, after so many people had come into the city for them.
You know, it's so interesting because if you take a close look, and in particular in the shoe industry in New England, you'll find that those shoe manufacturers were, in fact, profitable. They just weren't profitable enough. And so to make the kind of profits that shareholders needed, you had to go abroad to get the much cheaper labor and of course, the weaker environmental controls that made it cheaper to make the shoes. They were making money. They just weren't making enough for shareholders. So offshore they go. Lynn is out of luck. What's happening now in this period late in the 1980s with the collapse of the shoe industry? What's going on in Lynn at that time?
So at that time, actually, the population had decreased quite a bit, which I think happened in a lot of industrial cities in the U.S., the population, kind of people moving out of those cities, and a bunch of Latin American immigrants were coming in. So you have lots of Dominicans came for those shoe, jobs in the shoe industry, but once that was dead, they kind of stay there. And, you know, the city, I don't think, has really truly recovered from that moment, even though there have been attempts to kind of revitalize the downtown and trying to get more jobs. GE is currently the main employer still. It still has a plant in Lynn and quite a few people work there. But as it is, I think the economy is a little bit depressed right now and, you know, they're just trying to get past that moment.
What are they doing? We talked about 30% or roughly 30% of the population foreign-born. You gave us a rough sketch of the diversity. How diverse is it? And culturally, what's it like in Lynn? We get the feeling that economically it's pretty depressed, but culturally it might be pretty interesting, isn't it?
It's so rich. So you have 30% foreign-born population, which is really, really high, much higher than the U.S. number and the Massachusetts number. A big chunk of that, about 20% of that 30%, is made up of Dominicans. There's a lot of Asian countries as well represented, Cambodians in particular. And then you have something that's really interesting. Lynn is a refugee resettlement city, an official refugee resettlement city, which means that a lot of refugees, when they come to the U.S., once they've been granted refugee status, they end up in Lynn and they either stay there or are resettled elsewhere. And the reason why Lynn is one of those cities is because it's a lot cheaper than Boston, for instance, and yet it's quite close to Boston. It has a good transportation system, public transportation system. So the idea is that refugees will be able to settle down pretty quickly and adjust to American life. So they were getting, and they are getting a lot of those, people from a bunch of different countries. When I was there in 2012, 2013, the Iraqi population was the fastest growing from the war. And I think by the time I left, I think during those days, the first Syrian refugee was coming. I don't think the Syrian refugee population has grown much, but you can see that, you know, there's a lag between these conflicts and when people are kind of resettling.
Now, your multimedia series includes some audio with interviews that you did with people, and you talked with one refugee from Bhutan, Sarita. Tell us a little bit about her.
So Sarita was a Bhutanese refugee. She was living in a Nepalese camp. She was the first part of the first Bhutanese family that moved to Lynn, and her story is quite interesting because she was the one, when she was pretty young, a high school student, she heard about the possibility of moving to America from one of her teachers, and she decided that she kind of really wanted to do that, and she went to her parents and told them about it, and they were kind of dismissive. They said, you know, you're a little girl, you can't make these decisions, and it turns out they kind of listened to her. They came over.
Let's take a listen to your conversation with Sarita.
I still remember when my dad and mom agreed to come here with me. That was my happiest day. That was the first time my parents listened to me, like for the big decision. And I never made any decision in my life before then that. One of my teachers, he told me about the immigration thing. And I was really interested about that. And I came back to home and talked to my parents. And my dad actually totally disagreed with me. And he said that you are still little kids. You don't know anything about life. So how could you gonna be manage you know, the things in America, because for us it will be really difficult there. Finally, I was able to convince my parent.
There you go. That's Sarita, one of the people that my guest today on The State of Things, Andrea Patino Contreras, spoke with as part of her multimedia project that is now on view. You can see the interactive, it's an interactive website, and it's also at the Duke Center for Documentary Studies through April 13th. I guess that also suggests some of the cultural problems that people have in dislocating. You know, you come from one culture, and the older generation knows how that works, and the kids kind of pick up on what's happening here. That culture clash becomes yet another problem they have to navigate when they get here.
Yeah, definitely. And that's evident as well in Sarita's story. You know, as the younger one of the family, she kind of took a lot of the responsibility, I think, for her parents. She kind of learned English faster than they did, and they were more kind of set in their ways, trying to find the ingredients they used at home. So it was kind of, you know, different challenges. And I think a lot of the responsibility kind of falls on the younger members of the family in that situation in many cases.
Latin American immigration as well. Tell us a little bit about Antonio.
So Antonio is from El Salvador. He came about a little bit over a decade ago as an unaccompanied minor. So he came in when he was about 11 years old with his cousins from El Salvador. He crossed all borders, and his parents had come here before him. So his mom left him with his grandparents in El Salvador, just looking for a better, you know, better opportunities. And at some point, you know, 10 years later, she kind of asked him to come. He didn't know. He thought his grandparents were his parents. And then, you know, that transition was, I think, very, very difficult for him. But
let's hear from Antonio.
Growing up with your grandpa and parents, not knowing your mom, like, growing up with them, I always thought that they were my parents, you know, calling papa, mama. It was hard for me to let him go, though. Yeah, letting my grandpa go, it was kind of hard for me. It was hard for him, too. He went through depression and started drinking and all that stuff. His business went down. And, well, since I left, yes, he went down the hill. Some people that live there don't understand what we got to go through in order to proceed in our dream, like to follow what we want to do. I mean, we didn't decide to come here. They just... Mom and dad, I guess our mom and our dad, like, wanted us here because it's better for us to be here instead of being over there. Especially where I came from, there's killings every day. It's not a day that goes by when people don't die. And that's the only reason. They want a better future for us, and it turned out to be good.
That's Antonio, a bit of audio from a multimedia exhibit by my guest, Andrea Patino Contreras. We're talking about it today on The State of Things. Interestingly enough, he posed a question to you that set you back a second or two. Tell us about that.
So when I finished interviewing Antonio, he asked me, why are you interested in this? And I said, I've always been interested in immigration as an immigrant myself. This is a topic that I feel it's very important. And at that moment in time, I was also dealing with my own immigration status. I was here on a student visa, which allows you to work for a year after graduation. And that permit was expiring pretty soon, and I wanted to stay in the States. And it was really hard, and I couldn't in the end. I had to go back home. And when I told him all of this, he said, well, why don't you overstay your visa and just become undocumented? And it surprised me, and it's something that no one had ever asked me. And I think that made me think a lot. It definitely speaks a lot to the different kinds of immigration experiences that people go through. They're very, very different. And to me, I had the luxury to choose to go back home and, you know, be with my family. But for a lot of people, they don't have that choice. Which is, for instance, the case of Antonio, if they were to go back, they go back to a very violent environment where they could be at risk to a lot of poverty, potentially. And that was really, I think, an illuminating moment for me in my own understanding of immigration and my own kind of experience in relation to the people that I was interviewing at that moment.
Interesting how it spotlights a real hierarchy of privilege in this country. We like to think we're egalitarian. We like to think we're classless, but if you think about the ways in which people are categorized, if you're undocumented, the lack of leverage that gives you in the workplace, the work is vital. Somebody has to do it. You're doing it. You're here for those economic reasons. You're vital to the economy of the United States. Then you're your own personal. So all of these hierarchies, which are absolutely invisible to us unless you shine a light in this direction, and then you see that we're dependent, in a sense, on keeping people in these particular categories.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's something you don't really hear much when you hear about immigration and discourses in the public sphere. You don't get this kind of nuances that are actually in place. And I think those things are important as well. And something that, you know, like all this visa permits thing, that system is also so complicated to navigate, you know, and that's something that we don't get to hear much about. So that was a good, very illuminating experience for me.
Well, thank you for shining a light on it for all of us, Andrea Patino Contreras. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Frank, for having me.
Andrea is a UNC grad student and former Lewis Hine documentary fellow. Andrea's multimedia exhibit, From the World to Lynn, Stories of Immigration, is currently on display at the Duke Center for Documentary Studies now through April 13th. There's more information at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our intern is Jess Clark. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.